Blog Talk Radio.
Movie Geeks United is on the air, and we're ready to get our geek on. Right, guys?
Abso-fucking-lutely, yeah.
Oh, Jerry. Pull another profanity in the first 5 minutes of the show, 5 seconds of the show.
Well, hey, I'm just trying to up the ante here. I mean,
we got some energy going on. That's great. So Jerry's obviously here with us, and Chris is here, too. Hey, buddy.
Hey.
This is going to be a fun night.
Oh, yeah.
We welcome everyone to our show tonight, and you know, we missed Wednesday night. People are used to hearing us every Sunday and Wednesday night. I got some mail from quite a few people. Where were you guys at Wednesday? You know, they genuinely missed us, so that touches us very much. And you know, to let everyone know, we've had a kind of a dry spell. We were afraid we'd have a dry spell in terms of guests, but then all these requests we sent out, they came back to us all at once. So from here on out, the rest of the month, we are booked. You guys want to hear what we got so far this month?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, let's do this. Wednesday, we have the director of the writer-director of Chapter 27, which I don't know if you guys have heard about this. It's played at Sundance. It's about Mark David Chapman, who assassinated John Lennon, and Jared Leto stars in it. He gained like 50 or 60 pounds. It was all over the press, but just for that alone. And he'll be joining us, as will Denise Mann. She's the author of a new book, Hollywood Independence, The Post-War Talent Takeover, which is the period of time in Hollywood right before what is generally known as the New Hollywood, when the 70s started and the Maverick started rolling in. Well, this period, of course, made that one possible, and it's a fascinating book. Then next Sunday, we have the director of a new horror film called The Lost, Chris Sivertsen, who incidentally is the director of I Know Who Killed Me. So that's some interesting questions there, too. And the lead actor, Mark Center. Throughout the month, we have Michael Ian Black. Are you guys familiar with him?
Absolutely.
He's one of the funniest guys in the world, in my opinion, part of Stella. That's excellent.
Absolutely. We have him the following Wednesday night. He's the co-writer of a new film called Run, Fat Boy, Run.
There you go. Yeah, the new Simon Pegg film, yeah.
He co-wrote it with Simon Pegg, and David Schwimmer directs it. And we're also welcoming back another comedian, Harry Basil. He came by last month to talk to us about one of his films. He's back again with the screenwriting brothers behind his new film, Fingerprints. And Mark Harris, Entertainment Weekly contributor and author of Pictures at a Revolution, will be joining us. Paul Schrader at the end of the month, but the show right before Paul Schrader will be a special tribute to Paul Schrader. And we have a lot of guests lined up for that one, one of which is confirmed, and I can tell you it's Dana Delaney has confirmed for that show 100%. And as you know, she was in Schrader's Light Sleeper and Patty Hearst. And we have a couple that are just on the fence, and I'm so excited to announce them, but they haven't 100% confirmed yet. So we're gonna hold off on that. And also, I wanted to make sure everyone knew before we bring on our guest tonight that we have an ad, like a commercial, a video infomercial, if you will, for the month of February. It tells you all about what Movie Geeks United is, how you can access us, some of our previous shows, how you can call in and be on the chat room, all the highlights of this show, because a lot of times it's very difficult to explain where people really get a sense of, you know, you're a radio station on the internet. You know, it's a new kind of concept for a lot of people. So if you want to embed that code, it is on YouTube under Movie Geeks United. Embed that code if you're a fan of the show. Put it all over the place. We're going to take over the net with this thing. All right, you guys ready to get started?
Yes.
I thought it would be a great idea. If you remember back, we're going to have a very nice, relaxed conversation with this gentleman tonight. If you remember back in August, we had him on. His name is Hal Masonberg, and he directed a film called The Plague, which unfortunately it was taken over at the post-production stage and completely re-edited. And a lot of the soul was taken out of the film in the process, as you can imagine. And he's been waging an online campaign to get a writer's and director's cut out there for fans to see. And he's had an overwhelming response, and I wanted to bring him on to see where we are now with that campaign. Hal, are you with us?
I am. How you doing, guys?
I'm great. Thank you so much for joining us again tonight. And I really want to have you on because I know that this campaign of yours is still going on. I wanted to know, first of all, how is it going?
It's actually going fantastic. It's continually surprising to me. The website spreadingtheplague.com is at about 10,000 hits at the moment. The petition has passed 1,000, and I'm still kind of getting daily phone calls and emails from people asking how they can get a copy, when will it be released, you know, so it's still going strong, believe it or not.
Well, so how many are you, tell me how many petition signatures are you aiming for, and at that point, what do you do?
Well, what I'm hoping to do, what my plan is at this moment is I'm actually trying to get a hold of someone over at Sony. Sony Pictures owns the distribution rights to the film, to the best of my knowledge. Screen Gems was the company that made the film. And what I'm hoping to do is actually lease the distribution rights to the writers and director's cut from them, in the hopes of being able to get it out there to people, DVD, Blu-ray, festivals. I get tons and tons of film festivals, top film festivals requesting to screen this, and of course, you know, at the moment, I have no legal right to sell copies to people or to have screenings.
Right, because they own the print.
So you're essentially
wanting to show them something that's something substantial that shows that the public has a real interest in that,
exactly,
in seeing this new cut.
And I think we're at that point. I think with the petition signatures and the number of hits the website is getting, and you know, there's a real outpouring of people who are saying, "Hey, I want to see this." You know,
well, we're gonna get you tons more tonight. That's our goal. So it's spreadingtheplague.com. It's an internet petition. They just log on and it takes no time at all, right?
No, exactly. The website itself has a direct link to the petition, and there's also a documentary that I put together with Dee Wallace and some other cast and crew members, talking about why they want this cut out there, and there's tons of interviews, you know, including the original interview that I did with you guys and a bunch of other stuff. 2 months ago, I had an article in Movie Maker magazine, page article, on the events that occurred leading up to How We Lost the Film and what I did after that, which was essentially to finish the film on my own.
Right. Let's refresh our audience's memories on this, because you said that the shooting of this film, and it's essentially a thriller slash horror film. It's James Vanderbeek is in it, and Dee Wallace, as you've mentioned. You said that the shooting of it went really well, and what happened at the post production phase? At what time did they take it from you?
Well, it's basically they took it from me the day my contract ended. And we keep finding out new information because it seemed like there was such a string of lies that were told throughout the process that it's still unfolding and we still find out information that we had no idea was going on. The long and the short of it is that, you know, we joined forces with Clive Barker's company after about 5 years of shopping the script around, my writing partner Teal Minton and I.
Mm-hmm.
And through them we went to a production company called Armada Pictures, who raised the money. We were told through foreign pre-sales. What we've learned recently was that it looks like Sony financed the film from the start. We had all been pretty adamant about not having any studio involvement because we were afraid that a studio would try to turn it into a slasher film.
Right.
Which was not what we were making, and we knew having Clive Barker's name attached would have a certain expectation, which we were also not aiming for. Clive Barker's people were very much on board with it not being your typical Clive Barker film. But unfortunately, through the string of events, we had a 20-day shoot, which was about 10 days shorter than what we had been told we would get. And, you know, regardless of that, we managed to do it. You know, everyone was just incredible as far as the Canadian crew and the actors, and I mean, everyone really came.
Bill Butler, your cinematographer. I mean, you had a top-notch crew behind this.
Yeah. Bill Butler, who still, you know, hasn't had a chance to come in and color time his own work. They also cut him out of the process, unfortunately. You know, and as you know, Bill Butler is the guy who did Jaws and The Conversation, and really incredible cinematographer. Basically, to the best of our knowledge, what we were told was that Clive Barker wasn't happy with the cut, and that Screen Gems had wanted basically a straight-to-video Clive Barker horror film. The day we walked into the editing room, I was told point-blank by a producer I'd worked with for 3 years, we're cutting out the characters, turning this into a killer kid film. Which was followed by, you know, about 20 minutes of intense verbal abuse. It was a real kind of Twilight Zone situation where you struggle for 8 years, get to that point, and then watch it sort of slip away.
You know, there's a couple of reasons why. Obviously, I think all of us are behind you because we love movies and we respect the artist. But there's a couple of things that really kind of touch me here. Is that I don't think this is an uncommon practice, and even among, you know, people that have been doing this a while, I think I just heard from you, Chris, that there are reports that the studio wants to take away Where the Wild Things Are from Spike Jonze because they don't think it's the movie that they signed up to make. But I'm thinking
there's rumors out there.
It seems like it happens
more often than we know.
Why did you hire Spike Jonze if you wanted something just like everyone else makes?
Exactly. Well, that's sort of the thing about this is that it's not something that happens to just first-time filmmakers like myself or you know, it happens to the biggest names in Hollywood as well. And it's why, you know, you'll find slowly a lot of directors will start going back to making low-budget independent films or go back to their country of origin in some cases because...
Right.
You know, they've realized they put their creativity sort of on the back shelf.
And since we've been doing this show, I've enjoyed every interaction we've had. And I'll go ahead and open up here because I haven't admitted this before. But you know, because normally we're speaking to the artists, but there was one particular show where we interviewed some studio heads, some people behind their own production company, the money people. And that was the most discouraging interview we've ever conducted.
Yeah, it's pretty pathetic.
Because they have no passion for movies. They see money figures, and they don't. And the movies are secondary, really.
Yeah, well, that's certainly been my experience. I was a writer for a long time for studios, and it's one of the reasons why I stopped doing that was. You know, it's sort of, they use the word artist a lot, and they say they want creativity and new ideas, but at the end, that's not, you know, what they want. And of course, there are good producers out there, there are people who do love film and will fight for what they believe in, but I think those are the rarities in the business, and unfortunately, in my dealings, I've ended up with the people who were, you know, anywhere from two-bit crooks to people who did believe in what they were doing but didn't have the constitution to stand up for what they believed in. And, you know, when it was time to say, hey, no, this is the film we set out to make,
right.
Instead they'd get silent for fear of losing their jobs or what have you.
Right. And watching the version that is out now on DVD, and it is in DVD stores now, the recut version, one that was taken away and recut from you, it works, but it's soulless. There's no psychology there. So it does play like a basic, a little bit dumbed down killer kids movie.
Yeah.
So what exactly is missing from that cut that you had planned for your original?
Well, this is the thing: is usually when people think of director's cuts, what a director's cut is, in most cases, is a longer version of the version that was put out there. You know, usually they take the director's cut and shorten it and take out some character stuff. But in this case, it's a very different animal. What they did with my cut was basically threw it away. From what I can tell, they threw the script away, the storyboards, and they completely recut it from scratch. So it's cut together different frame by frame. It's restructured. It's different takes. I mean, it's a completely different film. It's sort of, you know, as if they took the footage and gave it to someone who had no idea what it was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And said, hey, put this together, you know, and make it, you know, a killer kid film. You know, and our intent with this always was to make a film that wasn't actually geared towards horror fans. Not that they wouldn't appreciate it, but we sort of wanted to attract people who normally might not go to a horror film to give them something more, something that I felt I was missing personally from a lot of the horror films I was seeing. And the film that got made was, you know, made for, I guess, what they thought Clive Barker fans were.
Right.
But I'm guessing from the reviews of their cut, they didn't hit that mark either.
Well, this is something that we were talking about the last time you appeared too, is how you're able to deal with so many issues given the horror genre, just the nature of what it is. Issues that we see all around us, and with your film, it was about the kind of the permeation of fear, the fear-mongering that we're dealt with on TV and in everyday life, we're just taught to be afraid, and how that infects our children.
Yes, yeah. We wanted to tap into a social fear and say something, and I grew up with horror films that I felt did that, you know, and we talked about it last time, whether it was The Exorcist or Rosemary's Baby or Invasion of the Body Snatchers, you know, they touched something that, you know, was a social fear, something that already existed, and that's what we were attempting to do, and I believe we did it incredibly well, and the response to our cut has kind of shown that, especially in that we show it to people who normally wouldn't go see a horror film and end up kind of going nuts over it.
Yeah, yeah, and you can sense that is what is missing from this cut that's out in stores now. And it's completely aggravating because the movie has, as it's being shown now in video stores, it's got so much potential, and the potential is on your cutting room floor in your new cut.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, luckily for me, I have that cut. It's, you know, I still need to get back to the original 35mm elements. You know, I had to put my cut together from the dailies that I had on DVD. So, you know, quality-wise, it's not up to the standards that it needs to be, but it is highly viewable, you know, I believe much more impressive in this format than the other one is on its DVD release.
Right. So all of our audience, if you log on to, go to spreadingtheplague.com, and you go to the petition area, and of course you can research because you have video clips and interviews with all of your stars and all of your crew concerning the project itself and how it was compromised by the powers that be. You can sign the petition. It takes 2 minutes and at most, and Telemovie Geeks United sent you, of course. And Hal, I wish you the best of luck, and you have an open forum. Call back in our show anytime to give us updates.
Thank you, and I'll be taking advantage of that. I really appreciate you guys having me back on.
Absolutely, anytime, my friend.
Anytime.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Hal. Bye-bye now.
Take care.
It's Hal Masonberg, director of The Plague, and wanted to get an update from him. We spoke to him on August 1st, our Blair Witch Project reunion show, actually. So that's just frustrating, so, isn't it?
Yeah, and especially what Chris just said about the Spike Jonze thing, where the wild things are, I mean...
Yeah, you and I had that conversation just the other day, Chris, and it reminded me of Hal. And so that's what inspired me to ask him to come on again tonight. But isn't that amazing? I mean, and time again you see this happen.
Yeah, well, with the Spike Jonze thing, I don't think that, you know, it hasn't exactly happened yet, but that's... what the rumor is, and people are, that's the sort of the word around the campfire, is that they're extremely unhappy with it. But it's like you said, you know, if you're wanting a straightforward film, you don't hire Spike Jonze, you know.
And it's not going to be a straightforward film because it's not a straightforward book. It's a Murray Sendak book. It's just not going to be straightforward.
Yeah.
Yeah, and but particularly in the hands of Spike Jonze. I mean, we go see a Spike Jonze movie to see something that we haven't seen before.
Yeah.
You know, told in an inventive way.
Well, I'm sure that's exactly what it is, you know.
Yeah.
And but in this case, you know, it is only his third movie after all. And the guy's not infallible. It's possible the studio is right. Maybe it's a horrible movie. I doubt it, judging, you know, by his first two movies. I have a hard time believing that he's just made this unwatchable thing. It's probably just, you know, a Spike Jonze movie, a little out there, you know.
And his first two movies were Being John Malkovich and Adaptation, correct?
Those are his two feature films, but he's also done, you know, countless music videos,
but you can tell. I mean, this is an original voice just from those two films that, and the music videos that he's done alone.
Oh yeah.
So I wish Al the best of luck, and we're here for you anytime you need us. What's been going on this week, guys? I know Jerry, you've seen quite a few movies this weekend.
I saw a couple movies. I don't know. Have you seen anything? You had a wedding to go to though, so you probably didn't see anything.
Yes. Yes. Unfortunately, no movies that night, so no movies at the wedding, even though I did get something from The Honeymoon, which I'm looking forward to watching. But, you know, I feel like there's nothing out there that really I want to drop down $10 on, and I know that I'm about to attend the film festival where I'm going to be seeing three movies a day for a week, so I know I'm kind of storing up.
Right. Now, you got to get that stamina going, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I actually went and saw a movie this weekend, and I felt like you at the beginning of the weekend. I felt like there was nothing really good out there. But I went and saw The Bank Job, and I got to tell you, I got to agree with Jerry's review of the movie. It's a really, really entertaining movie. Even with all this great press it's been getting, I was still kind of unconvinced.
Right.
But, it's actually extremely entertaining. It's so it was such a big surprise for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great film. I mean, truly, unexpectedly, you know, I was looking forward to it, but I had no idea it would be that good.
Yeah.
It's just, what makes it good? Is it just a solid genre movie? Or
It is a solid genre movie, but it's also a lot more complex than it looks on the surface.
Yeah.
Actually, I was thinking, it's not quite as complex as something like L.A. Confidential, but it does have a lot of things in common with a movie like L.A. Confidential in that, I mean, it's got an unbelievable number of speaking parts. There's a lot of characters in this movie.
Tons of characters.
And it seems, of course, it's based on a true story, and it's unlike a lot of heist movies in that it seems very plausible. Like, it never at any point do you go, oh, come on.
Right.
It's all very much grounded in reality, and for that reason, it's all the much more enjoyable to watch because it's done with such tension.
Yeah.
And it really builds. And I'm telling you, I haven't seen a movie. It's paced like one of the Bourne films, for instance. The pacing of this movie is really remarkable because it moves like a bullet. I mean, it's just one of the quickest movies.
Yes, it does.
Also, I got to say, it opens up with great. You know, really hot sex scenes. So
yeah, with Princess Margaret.
Yeah, with Princess Margaret. I like when a movie earns its R rating within the first 10 seconds.
Yeah, that's all.
Like our show tonight.
Exactly.
Hey, you do anything I can do to help.
All right. Why didn't you show your tits in the first couple seconds of this show, Jerry?
Exactly.
It's radio, baby.
Yeah, that's true. Everyone should give this movie a chance you're right, Jimmy. It is kind of a crappy time right now for movies.
Yeah,
but this is one of those that there's more to it than it seems.
If they seem like they're releasing it at this time of the year because it's what's his name, the lead actor? I'm sorry,
Jason Statham.
It seems like his time of the year for his transporter type films to be released. Is this the same audience or no? It seems
no.
I don't think so. No, that's the thing. I'm watching it. Because I always loved Snatch, and I always loved Jason Statham in Snatch. That was the first time I saw him. And ever since then, I don't want to, you know, crack on what he's done. He was, after all, he had a small part in Collateral, but for the most part, he does movies like The Transporter, which I can't say I'm a fan of, or War. You know, things like this are just like the Kung and Crank, Kung Fu, like movies with.
I think War is probably the worst. The worst
yeah.
of those.
I actually didn't even see that one. And I was starting to think in the last couple months, as much as I like him, he kind of seems like maybe his career is going into a Steven Seagal-type territory. Is that
right?
And this movie, not only is the movie good, he's actually very strong in the lead.
Yeah, he is.
I think Richard Roper compared him to Bruce Willis, and I would second that. He does have some of those qualities.
He has the potential to really break out. I mean, I don't mind the Transporter films, but you know, I hope he doesn't end up like Steven Seagal. That would be awful.
What's the difference
between what it looked like he was doing for a while?
Yeah. Oh,
it's a difference between, like, I think it all comes down to director. Either you have a director that challenges you and actually directs you, or they tell you, "Give me your thing." You know, show me what you've given us. You know,
right.
do your thing. You see that with, you know, my favorite actor, Pacino. You can tell that directors don't challenge him. They're like, "Just give us the Pacino thing."
Just yell.
Yeah. So, you know, and we thought that there's countless takes of this. It's just opportunity and the right people. And, you know, when Tom Hanks was doing Bosom Buddies, did we know that he'd be a two-time Oscar winner?
No, not at all.
You know, the opportunities come down the pike at the right time and to prove yourself.
Yeah.
So, I'm glad that he came through with a great, another great performance
yeah.
as a lead.
Another thing about him is... he's bald, and I'm watching the movie, and I'm looking at him, and you notice it when you see the previews. Oh yeah, he's the bald British guy. But you watch the movie; it's not like he shaves his head.
He's bald. You're right.
Like, he's a balding man, and he's got like the crown that goes around the back. You know, like kind of like the Homer Simpson hair. It really, and somehow it doesn't like he doesn't look like one of the because you kind of we have this thing where we see guys like that, and it's like, oh, he's balding, and you kind of look like a sad sack kind of fellow. Not at all with this guy. He just really, you believe that he has balls, and he very, very readily kick your ass.
Yeah.
So all of us are in agreement. I haven't seen it, but I'll agree with you guys. The Bank Job is a great.
It's really that, and the other movie I saw this year that I really liked was In Bruges. I think both of these are really, if they're playing near you, go see them.
Right.
They're worth it.
Double
right.
feature situation.
Yeah.
There's another actor that keeps getting better, Colin Farrell.
Yeah.
With every
absolutely.
Opportunity, yeah. I see in the chat room that somebody made a good point. Anthony actually made a good point, as he always does. Our number one fan, Anthony T, in the chat room. We're talking about compromised cuts. Fanboys is another example. That's the most recent. And I know that Anthony wrote me and said, you know, you've done a show on Fanboys with the star Chris Marquette and the director, but now that it's been taken over by the studio and it's I guess it's being hacked to pieces, could you do another show? And so I recontacted people, and I guess I'm too late. They all had to sign a confidentiality agreement. I hate those.
Yeah, they suck.
That's a new phenomenon, isn't it? Ever since the event movies kind of started.
Yeah.
It's just so bothersome.
Yeah, they are. So Fanboys is pretty much butchered.
Yeah, I think it's by the sound of it. By the sound of it, it is. It sounds like, you know, they cut the soul out of Hal Meisenberg's movie. They cut the heart out of Fanboys.
How ironic that it happened to Fanboys and not
yeah.
A Minute, which is the movie it should have happened to.
Well, and Fanboys alone, a movie made by the fans.
Right.
You know, it's all in the title, too, you know. It's not made by the studio heads and that kind of thing. They don't know what the hell the fans are.
No, they don't know. They, you know, it goes back to what our guest was saying earlier, and it goes back to what David Lean talked about. You know,
right.
The people in the money department are just out of touch.
They are. And
the MBAs are out of touch.
I can see where they get anxious. In all honesty, in all sympathy, I can see why they get anxious and they start biting their nails at the end. Oh, gosh, I don't know if this will make any money. But if you're not in it for making the best product, not product, the best film possible, then don't be in it. I mean, I just...
But it is product.
But there, you know, you did your slip there, but you're right. That's what it is. It is product.
That's what it is to them.
Product.
That's what it is to them. But
that's what it is to everybody.
It's what it was to
product.
Them. To Cecil B. DeMille, to Griffith, to all of them from the time the business started. But it was smart product for a long time. It was smart product. It wasn't always about just how can we get billions of dollars. Now, it was always about making money, but they were somewhat literate, and you had people who were passionate about the art form. You don't have that once you get to the 1980s. You have the MBAs.
Somebody that knows anything about
the
art form. I would go for anyone that appreciates movies, anyone that knows anything about the art form, because what's happening is, in trying to make it appeal to everyone, they make it appeal to no one because they compromise it so much. And it frustrates me. But, you know, there's still a number of great movies every year. I mean, we saw great movies, you know, by the truckload the past couple of years.
Yeah, it's not that. But you do, in the 80s, you do have a star where you just had people who don't really care about the art form. It's just a business to them. And it, unfortunately, they're, you know, what is it? The joke is, you know, you want to come in and make the 400 blows, they want to make the 400 blowjobs. I mean, that's what they want to do.
But, you know, if you go the other way, quite frankly, like we saw with the fall of, you know, the golden age in the 70s, you let the artists have complete freedom no matter what, and that doesn't quite work either. So
no, it
doesn't. There's got to be a delicate balance in between somewhere, and they really... You know, I don't agree completely with the artist. I mean, I lean towards the artist like you guys do, but those studio heads, they're necessary, too. It really is a business and an art form, unfortunately.
No, you're right, and it is a delicate balance.
Yeah.
Well, if you think back, I mean, this is what's interesting about this book that I'm reading for our guest Wednesday night. Chaplin was given his own studio. I mean, the artists were given United Artists to run.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that's a fascinating history right there. And the artists, as it is now, still run it. I mean, that hasn't been true throughout their history, of course. But now they're back. Tom Cruise and his producing partner are running United Artists. So it's almost like a full circle kind of thing.
It is. But, given that it was run by the artists, it hasn't been any more or less successful than any other.
No, it has pulled itself up from drowning many a time.
Yes.
This last one being Tom Cruise saving it, but it just celebrated its 90-year history. You know, that is a piece of Hollywood history right there that I think sentimentality for what that represents has kept it going more than anything.
I think that's the main reason it's afloat.
Yeah, that's my take on it. So the Bank Job is a great movie. I haven't even I've watched very few movies on DVD. I we'll be talking about DVDs later, but I've watched a couple that I'm anxious to tell you guys about when Aaron comes on at the top of the hour. Anything on home video that you guys have seen? I finally saw Assassination of Jesse James.
Did you like it?
Oh.
I did like it.
Okay,
I liked it a lot. I liked it a lot. I thought it had a lot of really haunting things in it, and I was surprised. I don't know why I was thinking Brad Pitt had a supporting role, really, and he's featured throughout. I mean,
he's star of the definitely
movie.
In it.
I didn't know why. I thought he was just some guy that popped in and out kind of enigmatically throughout the movie.
Although,
Casey
to
Affleck,
be perfectly honest, he's not any bigger or smaller part than Robert Ford.
No,
that's a little strange that they did that, but you know.
Yeah, but they're both so good, and Brad Pitt's at the time now in his career. I mean, he's always been an interesting actor, and you could see him as he's gotten so much stronger as his career has progressed. I think he's at the stage now where he knows his power to hold the screen, and this is his performance to do that. I mean, the non-blinking, just with his eyes, he holds it, man.
He does this thing that Ed Norton does. Maybe he picked it up from him, but. So Ed Norton has always had this ability to, you can actually see the gears in his head turning while he's looking into the camera.
Right.
Brad Pitt absolutely does that in this movie. You can see those gears turning and where his thoughts are going. And he does
those are absolutely the best actors. And I'm telling you, this is exactly what I was talking about today. I'm getting into this HBO show, and then we'll get back to Jesse James. This HBO show, In Treatment. And I guess it's really caught on, particularly with women who I guess are falling in love with the Gabriel Byrne character. I don't know. There was some article in the LA Times about that. But it comes out 5 nights a week. They're different patients every night of the week. He is a patient of his own psychiatrist on the last night of the week. They're 30-minute episodes. And if the art of acting is listening. I mean, this is the performance to end all performances, because he is so fascinating, and he spends the whole show listening, and you cannot take your eyes off of him. That's powerful acting right there, and I think that's what we're speaking to with Brad Pitt in that movie, Jesse James, and a lot of the best performances.
Yeah, that's true. Another thing about Gabriel Byrne, though, it's interesting because he's in two of my absolute favorite movies of all time, both performances, he kind of does that same thing, Usual Suspects and Miller's Crossing.
Right.
Yeah, there you go.
A very quiet character who listens more than he talks in both those movies.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not saying that's all he can do, because I like Gabriel Byrne very much, but he does it extremely well here.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. And I think that's the most powerful acting. I think anyone can scream and holler, but it's in those moments where you don't say anything that really really proves your worth as an actor. I think De Niro's great at it. There are a number of shots of De Niro thinking, and it sounds so boring and plain, but believe me, next time you see a film, pay attention to those moments where they're not saying anything, they're just thinking. And that tells you how good they are as an actor. But Jesse James, I thought maybe it was a little too long. That's my only complaint about it. I thought the performances were great. I was really haunted by that last shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's something about that freeze frame last shot that really kind of stuck me. And Chris and I, you and I were talking about that too, last shots in movies.
Oh, yeah.
How they just leave you with your jaw on the floor.
Yeah.
And you came up with a great example.
My favorite last shot of a movie of all time is from one of my favorite movies of all time, David Cronenberg's The Fly.
Oh, that's a great one.
The movie ends with the main character taking a shotgun blast to the head, you know.
Mm-hmm.
As no better, like, how can you do that in a movie?
And that last shot is like
blow his head off.
The fog and the steam and the decapitated Bonnie the Fly, and she's just sobbing over it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
really, the whole movie is just built up to this moment, and it's like this amazing, amazing scene, and it just ends. That's it. He's dead. It's over.
It's done. Yeah. Over with.
And I can't agree with you more, Chris. It's the one horror film that makes you cry. Mm. It's a monster movie that makes you cry. And is there any other movie like that?
No.
It stands alone.
I'm glad that you are a kindred spirit with me, because I've always thought that it's one of the most underrated horror films and one of the most underrated movies, actually. I'm always surprised when, you know, the best of, 100 greatest lists come out. It's never on there, although it was a couple years ago. I think on Richard Schickel's...
Wait a minute, it's one of the better remakes.
It's one of the better remakes.
You
know, it belittles it to even call it a remake.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean,
he really did something.
He took that, and I don't have a problem with the Vincent Price, but he added a whole new dimension to that film.
Right.
A totally new universe. It took it in a whole new direction.
Yeah. Yeah, that movie, Cape Fear, these are the kind of movies that, you know, Michael Bay's production company needs to run a film, you know, film school on. If you're going to be remaking things like, you know, The Thing and Escape from New York and Rosemary's Baby and things like this.
Well, they're remaking Rosemary's Baby now.
That's the rumor that came out this week.
Yeah.
Yeah, I
Isn't
know.
Great?
I feel the same way. But what I'm saying is, you know, if it has to be done, look at movies like The Fly and Cape Fear before you go off and make it. And not that it'll help, but, you know.
It's not going to help. They're not going to do that.
But I'm glad to hear that you liked Assassination of Jesse James, Jamie, because I enjoyed it very much. I didn't think it was too long. I mean, I can see where maybe someone could, but I was just enjoying the cinematography and that wonderful score from Nick Cave so much that it could have gone on for another hour, and I would have been very happy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got great cinematography. It's got a great feel to it.
Great
other
performance. Supporting characters, too. Sam Rockwell and that Jamie Ritter guy, both fantastic.
Yeah.
Garrett Dillahunt.
Mm. Yeah, Garrett Dillahunt was very good in it, actually.
Yeah, our man, who just signed on to do one of those remakes that we were talking about, Last House on the Left.
Yeah.
Does that really need to be remade? It was good the first time around. I don't see what you need to...
It was good the first time around when it was called
The
Virgin Springs.
Speaking of remakes, how do you guys feel about directors remaking their own films?
Are you talking about Funny Games?
Yeah. That's what I'm talking about.
Well, you know what, Jerry? I got to tell you, I haven't seen the original, and I'm not sure if we can get it around here, and I'm not a member of Netflix or anything like that. I would love to see it. But Esquire magazine just did a piece on it, And apparently, it's shot for shot.
It is a shot for shot one.
That's very interesting. So yeah, I'm really curious to see both of them. But you know, is there another example of a director remaking their own film other than Hitchcock? And
The Vanishing
jumps to mind.
The Vanishing.
Okay,
yeah,
The Vanishing
true.
Was
and
an
original one is far better. See, I watched the original The Funny Games a little while ago, and it's a very disturbing movie. You know, speaking of Last House on the Left, which I find equally disturbing, but Funny Games is a class by itself, but I don't, it's not something I want to rush out and watch again. It's good. It served its purpose. It's kind of like The Passion of the Christ or The Recent Girl Next Door. They're certainly, you know, good films, but they're, I get the point. I don't know if I need to sit through it again.
Yeah. Well, you know, the part of it is, and this is unfortunate, but a lot of, I think, this is my opinion, that a lot of American audiences just don't want to watch a foreign movie. Even, like I've said before, my girlfriend, who is very smart, I love her to death, she typically does not want to sit down and watch a movie where she has to read it. If we're going to be relaxing at night, she just wants to watch a movie and enjoy it.
You hit it right on the head.
Yeah, I can't say I completely blame. I like the idea of a director doing it himself, saying, okay, if Americans want to see my movie, I'll do it. Let me do it. I think that's really interesting. So it'll be exciting to see how that turns out.
Yeah, I'm curious, too, but it does look, I mean, it just looks exactly the same, and it is a disturbing film, very disturbing. It's not an easy film to watch.
Yeah, it if you guys are talking about Funny Games, it premiered at Sundance, and that was the general consensus that, and again, this was something that Chris and I were talking about, to act in a movie like that's just nonstop trauma.
Mm-hmm.
that has to be
it
so,
is. It's
so exhausting.
I don't know how. I mean, I got done watching the original one. I'm just like, you know, this is really messed up. And I read this little bit with the director in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, and he wanted to give Americans violence that is not consumer oriented, in your face, realistic, what violence really is.
Yeah.
That was his thing.
Yeah, exactly. Just to reiterate to some people that might just now be joining us, we have guests throughout the month of March, including the biggie that we have at the end of the month, Paul Schrader, who wrote Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, tons of other scripts, and directed movies like American Gigolo and Light of Day and Affliction, for God's sakes. Come on.
Don't forget
have,
The Comfort of Strangers and
yes,
Mike
you know,
Schieffer.
To tell, give you an idea how heavy a director Paul Schrader is. Chris Walken was in The Comfort of Strangers. Chris Walken himself said, that's the one character I couldn't shake.
I can see why.
You know, and you're a serious filmmaker when something like that happens. Garney just mentioned Autofocus.
Yeah, Autofocus is another crazy film.
This is talk about an uncompromising filmmaker with a vision. Paul Schrader encapsulates that just beautifully.
He always gets crazy performances out of William Dafoe. He really manages to get William Dafoe to really push forward. It's something to see.
Yeah, Willem Dafoe has become his muse man. But look at Greg Kinnear.
Greg Kinnear in that film.
Yeah.
There's a scene in that movie, and maybe we'll get to talk about it with him, where it just shows you how far gone Crane was. And he captures it perfectly in that film. There's one scene where he's on his cooking show or some show, and it just shows you how far gone he is. And it's just classic.
Schrader's another guy, very famous filmmaker. Probably, I would think, the most famous example of a filmmaker who's had a film taken away from him, too.
The Exorcist.
Unfortunately.
That's insulting. Yeah. Rennie Harlan is the guy you get.
Yeah, how unfortunate. But, you know, it'd be interesting to hear his take on that, since we were just
I really want to, yeah.
Really like to hear what he has to say about it.
Yeah, I'm interested in it, too, because in promoting the movie, or when he was about to go out and do it, he said, I have a chance to do something that's uniquely me and a box office audience movie at the same time. That's what he went into it thinking.
Much as I love Schrader, I was not a fan of either movie. But of the two, I did enjoy his movie more, even though I saw it second.
Yeah.
Clearly the stronger piece.
It is. You're right, Chris. But it's just like you said, though. It's just it was something that didn't really need to be done.
No. I mean, it was a flawed work, but you could still see Schrader, and I think he did bring, you know, some interesting things to it.
More than Rennie Harlan did, that's for sure.
And he was on a hell of a run before that, so I got to give him, you know.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
He really was, as a filmmaker, his films aren't as well known to, you know, the general audiences as a lot of other filmmakers, but he really was on a hell of a run there for a while.
Yes, he was.
In dynamite movies he was making.
The one movie I really love by him, Mishima, which I think contains probably the most beautiful thing that music that Philip Glass has ever written. But Mishima is excellent. The Comfort of Strangers.
Hardcore.
Is, you know, and Hardcore is very influential. All you have to do is watch Soderbergh's Traffic. There's one of the storylines where Michael Douglas is looking for his kid.
Yeah,
straight out of Hardcore.
Watch Shoemaker's 8mm.
Yeah. Oh, hey,
totally.
God, that movie. But Hardcore, awesome. You know, George C. Scott, late in his career, making that, and another one, Rage, and he was just
classic. That classic scene of George C. Scott, and he's watching his daughter
watching the film.
Turn it off.
He was great. I mean, he was great up until the very end. Mr. Scott was awesome.
And then when he has to go undercover in the porn world, and he's wearing the funky clothes.
Yeah.
Oh, what a treasure that movie is to watch. It really is. I remember watching that, you know, just about a year and a half ago I discovered it. I said, Chris, you got to see this movie, man. It's amazing. Why don't I know about this movie? And I knew about it, like, peripherally, but, you know, it hadn't struck me yet.
Well,
and, man, what a movie.
What's interesting, too, is that, you know, we had seen 8mm several years before, and then we saw Hardcore, which, of course, was made in, I don't know, what was it, 74 or something like that? I don't know exactly.
76, I think, yeah.
76?
Yeah.
I don't want to step on anyone's heels. I know 8mm was written by Andrew Kevin Walker, you know, and I have a lot of respect for him, but it's real fucking close. Like, I mean, it seems like
it is.
Some stuff was directly lifted out of that movie.
Yeah, I have a... When I went to go see, and this is where I basically shoot myself in the foot when I'm about to say, we went to go see that opening night, and I just, after it was done, I was like, you know, this movie, because I was looking forward to it mainly from the Andrew Kevin Walker perspective, and I was like, there are only two directors who could have really made this movie come to life, Fincher or De Palma.
Our lines are lit up, guys. Let me pick up one.
Oh shit! Okay.
We have a 646 area code. 646, go ahead.
Hey guys, it's Paul.
Hey Paul, how you doing?
Hey, the other line is actually Jerry. We're calling from the barbecue. We're calling from the Campbell's Trailer Camp premiere and the Boxing Day fun.
Oh, you guys are cool. I love you guys.
You want to hear one? Is that the other line here?
Yeah. Hello. Jerry's the other one.
Hey, Francis, what's up? How you doing?
Hey, guy, how you doing?
Hey, what's up, man?
We're here in Alexandria, Virginia, the 10th Sunday barbecue.
You guys
are
awesome for calling.
Yeah, Jerry couldn't make it, so we're calling into the show. So
what's going on out there today? Tell us about the event.
We're screening some films here. We're screening How Did You Lose Your Soul, Sweetheart, which you guys talked about on the show a while back, and Cannibal Cheerleader Camp, Paul Busetti's latest opus.
I can't wait to see that.
And we're raising money for our future Boxing Day.
I brought that up a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, that's right, and it was appreciated. So, it's all available on our website. You can go check out information, 10sundays.com.
So we were saying
we got to call the geeks. We must call the geeks while we're at the... Since we're going on simultaneously.
Is it hopping down there?
It's a simulcast. What's that?
Is it hopping down there?
It is hopping, yeah, it's hopping.
You got a keg.
That's right. You got a keg, so things are happening.
All right.
So tell us one more time. It's 10sundays.com to get all the information.
That's right.
Okay. All of our listeners, go to 10sundays.com.
Go and give money to this film, $5. If you do not, I'll be very upset.
And that's Jerry himself, Jerry has put his money where his mouth is. Personally.
That's right. You wouldn't like Jerry when he's angry.
Yeah, really, man.
Exactly.
Just ask my mom.
And congrats on getting Schrader, by the way. That's fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
I'll call in during that show and ask him some questions.
Cool.
Please do. It's less work for us. Thank you so much, guys, for calling.
Thanks for having us on, man.
Have a great time.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Take care, guys.
Thanks for calling, guys.
Oh, it's always nice to get calls.
It is nice to get calls. See, they're not afraid to call.
I know, they're fearless. They're fearless independent filmmakers.
They're the future of filmmaking right there, those guys. They're wonderful friends. I've only known them for 2 years, but they're really good guys.
That's right. Aaron's on the line. We're just about to do our DVD review segment. Some nice titles this week, actually. And you're going to hear them all early, like before they come out in stores. Isn't that awesome?
That's beautiful.
We give you the scoop here, man. The Movie Geek scoop. But I got to say, and I was warned about this.
Oh, shit.
To reserve our domain name, moviegeeksunited.com, I've been warned about this from this guy forever. And I'm Mr. Procrastinator. And so moviegeeksunited.com has been taken. Because, you know, we're wanting to build our own website in the very near future to feature our show and feature, you know, Jerry writes reviews every week, and, you know, I'll write reviews.
I wish I wrote reviews every week.
Yeah, you do.
Dan Three is like, you know, one of my editors, like, he doesn't write for us that much.
Yeah, you're a great writer. But you know, to feature our thoughts on movies and our show, it's going to be a great website. We're still going to do it. But MovieGeeksUnited.com has been taken by someone.
Who took it?
It's a mystery.
I bet Harvey Weinstein did it, man.
We're taking off, but that shows you how we're taking off. I mean, somebody saw the Movie Geeks United name and they thought, "Hey, I got to get in on that."
That's true.
Yeah, so it's flattering in one aspect. But any listeners out there that want to start your own websites, any kind of websites, don't be like me. If you want to make an impact online, go to GoDaddy.com right now because they have what you need. .com names are as low as $1.99, plus they offer world-class hosting, fast and easy website builders, and much more. Plus, this is special. As a listener of Movie Geeks United, when you check out, you enter a special code, and that code is Movie Geeks, and that'll save you an additional 10% on any order. Okay? So get a piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com and tell them Movie Geeks United sent you. That's a great deal. See,
that
we're
is,
giving
yeah.
back. We're giving back to our listeners. That's what it's all about. It's all about love here on the show.
Love.
Exactly. All right, so let's bring on Aaron. Aaron, how you doing, man?
What's up, fellas?
Hey, how you doing, Aaron?
I'm good. I just want to say, you know what? It's fine if they took .com, but I've always thought of us as a .edu. We're educational.
That's right. That's right, man. We're offering a service. And thanks for bringing that up, because then they'll take that tonight.
What's left? Wait, .net and .org are left. Okay.
No, .gov. We'll do .gov or Canada.
Or .tv, .tv.
Or .uk. I just want to say, I know we've been talking about some of these other movies that are coming up. I just want to put my two cents in and say that the first great movie of the year came out this weekend, and unfortunately it only came in at number five, but that's Roger Donaldson's The Bank Job.
Yeah, it was, without a doubt.
It is the first. I think the studio made a mistake. They obviously thought, we'll put it on 1,500 screens like we did Transporter and Crank, and we'll get all of that money real quick and get out. I think if they had done a Trainspotting / Sexy Beast / Layer Cake / Four Weddings type of word-of-mouth platforming, I think they could have gotten a lot further, and the film would have had a lot of legs. As it is, I do think there will be good word-of-mouth, but unfortunately I think the film is going to start disappearing before people start going.
You think next week's releases will crowd it out?
Will crowd it out. I mean, because it is one of those films, it needs to have, I think, been built upon, because the trailer makes it look like kind of a romp caper, and the first half is actually kind of a romp, light British caper. But then there's a big scene involving the police and some walkie-talkies.
Yep.
And it starts out funny and kind of humorous, and then all of a sudden the screws turn, and it rackets up the tension, and then the film, in that one scene, the film transitions from a British caper, light caper, into a very hard-edged, almost, you know, very suspenseful thriller.
Yeah.
And it's just
what he's good at. Donaldson's very good at that.
Roger Donaldson is just terrific. You know, I looked at his credits, and here's a guy. We got to do a show on this guy, because this guy does not get the credit he deserves. Going all the way back to 1982 with Smash Palace.
Smash Palace, a wonderful film.
Smash Palace and his Bounty.
I think his Bounty's just as good as the Marlon Brando version.
It's just as good. Early, you know, it's a different Gibson, a different Hopkins. An early Day Lewis, if I remember.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you have No Way Out, which is probably his most famous film. And then, you know, you have stuff like 13 Days, which is terrific. The World's Fastest Indian. The Recruit is a fun film.
I like White Sands, to be honest.
White Sands, it might have a little too much plot, but the acting is throughout very good, particularly Mickey Rourke.
Yeah.
Very good in White Sands. And the one film, I guess you could say his one blemish is still probably a guilty pleasure for some, and that's Cocktail. If I've heard reports correctly, Cocktail started out as a little small indie film, kind of a small little film, but the studio, you know, they wanted to capitalize on Tom Cruise, and they poured more money into them, into the locations and the soundtrack, and it just got out of hand. And so that's kind of his one film that you could say that always kind of gets ridiculed. But other than that,
I always thought Cocktaste would be a better name for that movie.
You know, but I mean,
a dirty show tonight.
But Roger Donaldson,
it's a dirty show, man.
So Roger Donaldson is a truly underrated director, and The Bank Job, like I said, it's the first. I'd been waiting for there's been a couple of decent films that have come out that have been watchable, but nothing really memorable. I give Bank Job my highest rating. I just think it's terrific, and if it had like Michael Mann's name on it, it would be the breakout role for Jason Statham.
Yeah, definitely.
Let's talk about this. Speaking of, kind of not so much on target about Michael Mann, but having to deal somewhat with him. Look at everyone's opinion on this. We've all seen the new Righteous Kill trailer, which is the new Pacino De Niro collaboration.
Right.
Cricket.
Yeah. Can you feel the excitement on the line?
Yeah, I know. I want to get everyone's opinion on this.
I forgot about the trailer until you brought it up yesterday.
Yeah.
I want to get everyone's opinion on this. Go ahead, Chris. Lay it on me.
It's just extremely unfortunate. Like, by the end of the preview, I was bored because they both seemed so bored. And I don't want to judge the movie before I see it, and I will be going to see it, obviously. But it really looks so bland and lifeless. It just, like, stinks of something that could have been so much more. That was my immediate reaction. Like I said, don't want to judge it before I've seen it, and I know that's what it sounds like.
You know, but that, to be honest, was our reaction when we first heard about the project.
Yeah, it was.
Solely based on who was directing it, sadly enough.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it looks. It looks exactly like my reaction when I heard about the project. I don't want to, you know, knock John Avnet, but let's start knocking John Avnet.
that could be our new theme song.
Yeah.
So, Jerry, go ahead.
It goes back to the early 80s. And I remember, like, when Cruise Confessions...
You always go back in history.
Yeah, I do.
It goes back to 1912, when there was an infestation...
1865, no.
The infestation of locusts in the Bible, it really goes back to that.
Yeah, no, but it goes back when I remember the radio ads for True Confessions, and how everyone was making a big deal about that, because, you know...
Okay.
And that was a good movie. I like that movie, and then Heat comes, and everyone's really excited about that. But you see the trailer for this... And I hate to say it, but it seems run-of-the-mill.
Yeah.
I hate to say that with these two guys, but 15 years ago, I would never have thought these two guys and all the actors would be in something so run-of-the-mill. But it looks that way.
The one promising thing about it is it does have that screenplay by Russell Gilwerks, or whatever his name is, who wrote Inside Man, but he's just not established enough for us to really say, oh, it's got his name on it.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. Aaron, what do you think?
I'm a little more pragmatic. I am of the belief that a good film can come from anywhere, and even if a director has had a couple of bad films, they can surprise you and have a good film. And John Avnet, just off the top of my head, I think his Copycat is actually a very good film, and that was a film that actually I felt withstood the weight of coming just like, I think, 3-4 weeks after Seven.
That's true, yeah.
And it was a good film. It was a totally different type of serial killer thriller, but it was a good serial killer thriller in its own way, and John Avnet was a big part of that film's success.
By the way, say serial killer thriller 3 times real fast.
Serial killer thriller.
Okay,
serial killer thriller.
Go ahead.
I can do it. And as for this trailer, I admit the trailer is not as... I think they're purposely trying to play down, not build it up like they did with Heat, because they've already teamed up once, so we can't really market on that because they've teamed up once before. So I think they're going to just go for the straight be pulp film that it looks like. And on that basis, I think that's what it should be judged on. Just because these two guys are in it, I don't think we should be expecting some kind of masterpiece. I think that's kind of that's kind of setting yourself up for disappointment.
Yeah, that's true.
And as for the trailer, I admit the trailer could have been cut a little better, but I learned a long time ago that obviously there's great trailers, but when a trailer is mediocre or bad, I try not to use that as, oh, the movie's bad, because there's been so many mediocre trailers that I went in just dreading the film that I came out thinking it's a great film and what an awful trailer. The prime example of that for me that I would use is the trailer for Changing Lanes, the Ben Affleck, Sam Jackson film. It had one of the worst trailers I thought I had seen. And when I went and saw the film, I was like, I cannot believe this thoughtful, very moody character study was being sold as an action film. And so,
yeah. Right. Bank Job is another good example. Bank Job's trailer is not terribly,
it sells
the impression
like,
that it's as good a movie as it is.
No, it
right.
sells it like a light. It sells it like a light caper, / Transporter 3 is what
right.
it sells it, and it's nothing like that. And so,
yeah.
I think Righteous Kill might be, my positive thinking is that I think that maybe if Russell Gerwich is a really a terrific screenwriter, and I think he is just on the basis of Inside Man, I do think that that could redeem it. I tell you, the one person for me, I know Jamie said he didn't really distinguish himself, but I think the one who impressed me in the trailer in just a brief moment was actually John Leguizamo, who looked like he belonged in the same scene with De Niro and Pacino and didn't look intimidated. Obviously, this comes from a guy who has worked with De Niro and Pacino on separate occasions.
Right.
But still, I'm a huge Leguizamo fan, so I'm excited to see him with those two guys again. So I'm a little more optimistic than I guess most people.
I was not blown away by the trailer. First of all, because of my Pacino bias, and it's De Niro's trailer. I mean, essentially. I have very low expectations, and I think with low expectations, I can only be surprised. And I think you can't expect another Heat. Heat is a once-in-a-lifetime movie.
Yeah.
Heat is like, takes the cops and robbers genre, and it makes it epic. It makes it spiritual. Jerry, you and I were talking about the spirituality of Heat.
Yeah.
There's something about that last shot where he's holding De Niro's hand. You know, the Moby music is playing, and the airplane lights, the plane's taking off. And there's something very undeniably spiritual about that movie. And all the way through it, I mean, just the mood of the film.
Right.
I think that while Michael Mann's Heat transcends the kind of cops and robbers genre, I think this one probably revels in it and plays it like Aaron just said, possibly as a B movie, where the trashy treasures that you love from that genre, with the two actors that epitomize, cops on film, I can take that. I can accept that, but I haven't been wowed so far, outside of the fact that Pacino and De Niro are in a movie together again, and they share all their screen time together.
Right.
I will say, when I first saw Heat, the first 20 or so times I saw Heat, I thought De Niro stole it. And recently, rewatching it, like 2 years ago, I rewatched it, and it clicked to me. I finally saw what Pacino was doing, because within all the yelling and all that kind of stuff, there was such subtlety there. That is a very subtle performance, and it takes you a while to get to it. And I finally saw what he was doing, and I thought, that does resemble a real person that isn't Pacino. He is playing someone there, and it registered.
Yeah, he is.
I think given what I've heard about this movie, and especially what I've heard is the ending of this movie, which I won't give away because it might be wrong, and plus I won't give it away anyway, even if it's right. I think that you look for a real subtle performance from Pacino in this. That's my prediction. Talk about acting with the eyes. I think that we're going to get a really delicious Pacino performance here. And De Niro, Jerry, you mentioned that he put on weight. It looks like he's put on some pounds. It reminds me of like Copland. Remember when he put on the heft and he had the Barney Miller mustache?
Yeah, the Barney Miller.
It's so great. I'm looking forward to the simple pleasures of watching the two of them together.
Right, of course. That's
yeah.
the selling point.
I think the thing about Copland, I think it's easier to say who did not put on weight for Copland.
Right.
Everyone put on some, heavy.
It took the cops donuts analogy a little too far.
Yeah, I will say this, as much as, you know, I say a good film can come from anywhere, but I will, obviously there is a big distinction between Michael Mann and John Avnet. Well, Michael Mann is a true artist, and John Avnet is obviously a journeyman director. So that qualifies my expectations for the film. And nothing else, the trailer to me is 100 times better than the 88 Minutes trailer.
I think 88 Minutes, having seen 88 Minutes and having not liked 88 Minutes, I think the trailer for that is brilliant. It makes me want to go out and see it.
Can I say one other thing about the Red Kill trailer here? Is that Anthony Michael Hall in the trailer that we keep seeing in the movie, apparently playing some sort of villain or something?
No, I think, isn't it the guy from a popular TV show, isn't it?
No, it's the guy from 88 Minutes that Pacino put on Death Row.
Yeah.
Same guy. Avnet used the same guy.
Yeah. And anyone else, just real quick, just as kind of a what-if question, who would hear, you know, if Pacino and De Niro were to act again, wouldn't it be fun if they did a 180 and they did, like, a, you know, an Italian remake of, like, Sunshine Boys? I think they could just, the next one, they could just go all out and do something, you know, do their own Grumpy Old Men.
I think both of them are brilliant at comedy, and I think that would be terrific.
Yeah, I would welcome it. I mean, we don't even know. We're all speculating about this movie. It could be very good, and it could be actually above average for the director. So
well,
you never know.
I hear Carlo Gugino gets freaky in the film, and so that's a plus for me.
That's right, but she gets freaky with De Niro, so I'm only half turned on. Okay, let's talk about DVDs.
Okay.
We got 25 minutes. Let's get through there. Our DVD segment of the week. What's our first title?
Why don't we get kind of the least of these titles, at least in my opinion, out of the way, and we'll talk about Sleuth.
Okay.
And I say that as just because in the quality of the other titles that we're going to talk about. I do not hold the original Sleuth in high regard like a lot of people. I think the Sleuth screenplay, both the 72 version and this 07 version, are just good exercises in acting and kind of plot mechanics. They're nothing more nor nothing less. So having said that, I do like this Sleuth as just kind of a fun exercise in style and of ham-bone overacting British style. And Michael Caine, and actually it's the first Michael Caine and Jude Law playing these kind of basically unrequited lovers. I mean, unlike the original, there's a true undercurrent of homoeroticism and S&M behavior going throughout the film that really gives the film an extra jolt of energy.
Yeah, it feels really like dangerous and intense during those segments.
And Jude Law, who, you know, going all the way back to the Chris Rock monologue joke, to me, this is actually his first truly live, fully awake performance that he's given in quite a while.
Because he's standing toe-to-toe, and he has no one else. I mean, he's standing toe-to-toe with Michael Caine, who is an idol of his.
Yeah.
Right.
It's just the two of those in the house.
And actually, think about it. He does better here playing the Michael Caine role than he did in
Alfie. Yeah.
Alfie, he was totally lost, and partly because that whole Alfie remake took the bite out of it by being a PG-13 Alfie when it should have been a hard R Alfie. But I
didn't care for the remake at all.
I didn't either, because it had none of the bite of the original.
Right.
The fact that it was PG-13 that pretty much guarantees you there's no sex when the whole film is about sexual prowess. So what's
right.
the point? And Jude Law just looked lost. Where here he's playing another Michael Caine role, and it's an R-rated film, and it really is a live wire act between the two of them. Eventually, I think Michael Caine wins out in the acting sweepstakes, but Jude Law does hold his own. And like I said, it is a very stylish kind of gimmick of a film.
Acting with his eyes. Michael Caine invented it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so
it
is what it is. It's nothing more. It's nothing less. And I've always thought Branagh, Jamie will disagree with it, I've always liked Branagh. Jamie, obviously, we both love Dead Again, but I've liked a lot of his later films. I'm actually a big defender of his Frankenstein, which a lot of people kind of
I think Frankenstein is really exciting filmmaking.
Yeah, it's really. It got
I like Henry V and Dead Again, and there's another one that he directed I like a lot.
Hamlet.
Well, his
Hamlet's
Hamlet,
good.
His Much Ado About Nothing, which if you just read that play at itself, it really is a very disposable Shakespeare play. I say
right.
this. I'm sure there's some people there. If there's any English scholars ever listening to the show, they probably just wrote me off as some idiot. But
yeah.
as an English major and having read Shakespeare's plays, Much Ado About Nothing is Much Ado About Nothing. But Branagh's take on it is really, it's one of the great romantic comedies of the 90s.
I was always hoping, because he had said, I guess it was sometime in the 90s, he wanted to do Macbeth, but he, because I forget what the last Shakespeare film he did didn't go over too well. And he said, no one really wants to see it, but I would love to see his take on Macbeth.
I would love to see that, if that's true, I don't know if he can go any further than Polanski's Macbeth, but that'd be interesting. Even though he had nothing to do with the production, his participation in Othello is...
Yeah.
I like that. That's a good one.
Look, I like Branagh. I think there's definitely... He definitely came out of the gate as a very young, early 20-something... Like strong, like Olivier, Orson Welles strong,
mm-hmm.
And anyone that writes their autobiography at the age of 30, there's a slash of great accomplishment and even greater ego at work there. But I do think he's extraordinarily talented. I think that he's great to be behind the camera in Sleuth, if only because he understands the delicacies of performance, the delicacies of the writing,
mm-hmm.
you know. And he's a visual guy. I mean, he made Hamlet, this four-hour movie, very, very visual throughout. And so he can take what is essentially a stage play, and I don't care what anyone says. Harold Pinter wrote the screenplay. It is a stage. It could just as well be a stage play still. And so it's just two guys in a house talking. He makes it as cinematic as possible in a couple of ways. He does some stylish things that he talks about in the commentary, which is like sometimes they're too spot on, like he bathes someone in green to represent envy. And sometimes it's very inventive, like how he stages the two of them at certain points in the movie, like a tennis match, like they're across the room from each other, back and forth. There's some interesting things that he does directorially in this movie. But I think that the house is ridiculous. I can't imagine anyone living in that house.
That, to me, is the fun of it. That house is hilarious. That pool.
I put a down payment on that house, too.
That pool in the house, that water.
Well, that's just it. That house does not exist. That house is an art director's wet dream.
And that's
fun. It's not believable to me. I mean, it gives you great angles. It gives the movie a great look, but it's a ridiculous house.
Well, and that goes in with the film because the story is ridiculous.
Well, the story is typically male, and it's exactly what Harold Pinter has always done. He's always written about that kind of male aggression, and he's always made it like had a sexual underlying tension to it. And this movie explores that. It's typical Pinter. What makes the movie is okay. The movie is just a step above okay to me. It's very interesting to watch these two people working together, but the disc is even better because the disc has these commentary tracks. It has a separate one from Jude Law because he was unable to join Kane and Branagh together. But just listen to that Kane and Branagh commentary, and it's exactly what you want from a commentary. I mean, it is an education to see how they brought this play to life, the acting tricks that Michael Caine uses, where he thinks his character's motivations are at this time in the movie, because their gears are always running. Both characters are always thinking, but you don't know what they're going to do next. That's that's the fun of it. And
right.
So to hear Caine decipher, this is where I think this character was here. This is what he was thinking. It's beautiful. It really is what DVD commentaries have always promised, like an education, a fun, insightful education for people who love movies. So I would recommend the disc based on the extras alone, but the film itself is perfectly fine.
To me, the film is a good. I do give it a recommendation, but... I do recommend the film to anyone who has asked me, but I do think that the only people who are really going to appreciate it are people who appreciate kind of this movies about movies. And what I mean is movies that all they are just the they're about the mechanics and the trickery that you can do in a film. And so if you appreciate kind of film that are really just contraptions, like a movie like Death Trap.
Right, that's what it reminded me of, yeah.
And they have no real life outside of, you know, outside of the big screen.
Right.
And you like them for what they are, just machines, then you'll really like Sleuth. I'm actually a big fan of Death Trap. I know a lot of people don't like Death Trap, but I think Death Trap
is most, because I did that play, I remember. Yeah. I like spent 6 months
it's
doing
it. It's a great play, too. I love the play.
But Death Trap is more about the crime, like the intricacies of the crime and stuff. This is more about male politics. I mean, this is really a relationship back and forth.
Except for the last act of Death Trap, when they're really, I mean, that last act of Death Trap is really kind of at the time, was kind of an update of Sleuth, where they're going back and forth on one gets the upper hand on the other. And also, you know, the fact, and there they are lovers, you know, and so it's out in the open. So Death Trap at the time was a little more, you know, up front. And so I think now Sleuth comes about, and it what it hinted at in the original is now up front and, you know,
right,
front and center. So, like I said, it's a contraption of a movie. It's on that basis, I think it's a worthwhile film.
And it comes out Tuesday, March 11th.
Yeah.
So we gave you a 13-day scoop on that one. Woohoo! I'm all about the scoops.
So
what's our next film?
Okay, well, I guess we'll keep on. Before we get into the stuff we can just agree about, let's keep on to the other film where we have slightly divergent opinions, and I guess that is Dan in Real Life, which is the Steve Carell film, which did a quiet, I think, $35-40 million at the box office last year. It did quietly well. And I do believe that in a lesser year, like I always go back to the year 2000, which is like probably the worst year of this decade, if that film had been released then, Steve Carell probably would have gotten an Oscar nomination. Because that probably says more about the quality of stuff that came out last year than it does about Steve Carell's performance.
Right.
But I do think Steve Carell gives a terrific performance. He's a really good actor, not only in this film, but he's shown him before. Not, obviously comedy, but like in Little Miss Sunshine, he's really, it's a really fine, you know, layered performance. And in here, it's a great performance. He plays this advice columnist, widow father of three girls at the ages where it's hard to raise three girls if there's no female figure around. And so he goes to his family, their annual family reunion, where this family in Rhode Island, it's their one time where they all can be together and hang out, and they do Scrabble and they have lunches and, you know, play football and do talent show, you know, kind of, you know, the real precious.
Like every family.
You know,
I thought it was a very charming movie.
I think it's deceptively very moving, because
mm-hmm.
even the trailer made it look like a Steve Carell pratfall movie, and there is a fall off the roof and so forth. But underneath it, there's a lot of sadness, there's a lot of poignancy, there's a lot of insight into grief and to, you know, responsibility on how to raise, you know, being a father and how to raise girls, and about, you know, at what point is can you call a crush really love, and at
mm-hmm.
what age? And I think it's very insightful, and it does this in a very light way. And like I told Jamie earlier, I think it's one of the healthiest, most well-adjusted portraits of family I've ever seen in movies. And I say that.
And today, thanks to Garney, we know that today is Juliette Binoche's 44th birthday. Da, 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 da.
And I will say that Juliette Binoche,
she's great, and thank you, Garney, for that.
That's very good. 44. Wow, and she still looks.
And I love it too, Garney. So yeah.
You know what was that joke that Sarah Silverman told about the ET birthdays? It's he annihilated 6 million Jews. Was it Gary Coleman? Adolf Hitler? Or Larry Hagman? Coming up next on the ET birthdays.
I'm gonna go with Larry Hagman.
Damn, man.
Anyway, that's just a random joke.
Okay, but no.
So, Jay, you love the film, too.
Yeah, I was really, and, you know, it's one of these films, you know, from the trailer. I thought it was a nice trailer, but I was pleasantly surprised by it. I have no complaints with this film.
And I have two highlights I want to give real quick. One, and I think Jerry would agree, and I think everyone would grudgingly agree, but I wholeheartedly endorse that Dane Cook has a career as a supporting actor. and is a very good supporting actor just on the basis of Dan in real life. He is really, he plays that brother character beautifully.
Yeah, where he's not the focus.
Yeah, and he's terrific in it.
Yeah.
And I want to say, and just on the music, because I love music as much as I love movies, just about. I've always thought that Pete Townsend's Let My Love Open the Door is one of the lost great songs of its era.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that it's used in this film is just perfect. And
yeah,
so I'm glad
it's a
that
good
it was
scene.
Used. It wasn't used as a joke the way Adam Sandler has used kind of those 80s pop songs in his film.
Right.
Chris, were you able to watch Dan in Real Life?
I haven't seen Dan in Real Life, but two things real quick. I love that song too, Aaron, but to say it's underused is unbelievable. I'm not sure. It seems like the one go-to song for the quirky romantic scene in movies. But secondly, I want to say about Dan in Real Life, I haven't seen it, but I want to see it because it sounds like you're saying that this movie is a nice follow-up to Peter Hedges' first movie, Pieces of April, which I liked very much, and I thought it was a really nice little unusual family comedy.
I think it's a vast improvement over Pieces of April because Pieces of April, unfortunately, its big drawback is that it really doesn't have a final act. Really, to me, this film is more in line with his novel, What's Eating Gilbert Grape, that Lasse Hallström directed. With What's Eating Gilbert Grape is one of the great portraits of an eccentric family that we've seen in like 20 years. And so that's the one that I think about. But Pieces of April is a good film.
I've been meaning to see Pieces of April. I haven't been able to see it.
No, it's a wonderful. That's a wonderful film.
Patricia Clarkson and Oliver Platt play just.
Yeah, I remember Chris raving about it. Chris is absolutely right. And when Chris was raving about it, he was raving about it in a way that I knew I got to see this movie because I'm a crybaby for some of the same things that Chris is.
Yeah, it's a crybaby film.
It showed that Katie Holmes actually could act if she ever felt like it.
Yeah, that's why I don't like to hear people, you know, a lot of people don't like her, but I always think back to that when I hear someone saying something bad about her, because it's a really touching, and it's a great performance, but it is very touching and sweet.
It is a good performance.
It's touching, you're absolutely right, Chris, it's very touching.
I do understand the Katie Holmes animosity after just how...
She became a Stepford wife?
No, after how out of her...
All right, we're getting off topic.
Okay.
We've run out of time.
Okay.
I have no time to give you my opinion on Dan in Real Life, so let's go to the next one.
Shit.
Okay, before we get to the big one, I guess I want to give a...
Let me give my opinion on Dan in Real Life. I can't go by without it.
Okay.
I thought it was great. I thought Steve Carell was great. I thought that the casting of he and Dane Cook as brothers was terrific. There's a sense of family that is more powerful in this movie than most movies that attempt this. And the extras will show how they achieve that.
Mm-hmm.
It has some good extras, but it has one of those outtake things that are lackluster, where you don't really know where they start laughing, what they're laughing at. It's just a series of people laughing, generally. And those aren't the outtakes I like. But anyway, that's a small quibble about the DVD itself.
Gag reels could be saved for Burt Reynolds' car movies, and that's about
it. I think that I was disappointed. I didn't like Julia Binoche in it. I thought she was pretty, but she seemed very distanced and odd in it, almost like her voice was being dubbed in it somehow. I felt distanced from her.
That I don't disagree with.
I also didn't like what direction it went off on as soon as he went to the parents' house. I like the fact that he was a single dad struggling with three daughters. And I wanted that explored more than to just go in this very kind of familiar, kind of comedic, kind of I'm in love with my brother's girlfriend thing, that whole subplot that takes over from the first 20 minutes on.
But even that is different, I'll just say real quick, because in any other typical film, the other brother would be such a jerk, and you'd be wondering why is she even with him. But the fact that they make them loving brothers and that Dane Cook is a good guy, that's the real tension of the film.
Obviously he's a smart guy who wrote it, and that's why I wish he would have been smart all the way through it instead of resorted to the routine so much in it. So let's go to our next movie.
Next film, and we're going to go G here, Jerry. So watch the language. going to talk about the Platinum Edition of 101 Dalmatians real briefly. The reason I want to bring this up is because 101 Dalmatians is one of those animated films that probably gets forgotten. It's not obviously one of the great Disney films of the early days or the latter days. It's one of those when Walt Disney was kind of middling about, and I think it came out like 4 or 5 years before he passed, and so it was one of those kind of churning them out kind of deal. But it's an interesting film in that it is a good story, has a great villain, and one of the things that's interesting about it, it's actually a very quiet film, and a very, you know, kind of it's a very quiet film and a very just gentle film, and you really didn't get that. I think the early Disney films were very emotionally intense and traumatizing, frankly, like Dumbo and Pinocchio and Peter Pan. Those things will give you nightmares. And then the later stuff, you know, Lion King and Aladdin, those things are full tilt boogie all the way through. But if you look at something like, you know, 101 Dalmatians, it's a very quiet, very gentle film. And it's funny that in this, you know, this new reemergence of animation in the last 15 years, 20 years, we really haven't had any, you know, real simple kind of gentle animation. And I think 101 Dalmatians.
What about The Iron Giant?
That is a good point. And The Iron Giant, that's why I think The Iron Giant is so popular. Unfortunately, Warner Brothers did not know, you know, did not care or did not know how to advertise it, and they kind of blew it. And so it kind of went on with this self-fulfilling prophecy of, you know, obviously we need to speed it up, where that's not the case. I think the closest to that is obviously Ratatouille had some quiet moments. So I think maybe Brad Bird might be the one who brings this approach back. And so this Disney DVD, I bring it up because it's the number one DVD in America right now, and obviously parents buy it.
Is this a limited edition kind of Disney thing, only on shelves for a certain amount of time?
Yeah, like all Disney animated stuff.
Yeah. What are the extras like?
The extras are, you know, obviously, you know, you get the feature, you get a few featurettes on the making of it, and those are always fun because they talk about the history and the approach of it, and then there's the desktop games and for the kiddies and all that. My one complaint of 101 of the 101 Dalmatians is that I think they spend so much creation of Cruella de Vil, which is memorable character, that they don't give the dogs enough personality, where I think if they just picked maybe three or four dogs and really, like, created some characters.
They should have given each one of them a personality.
Well, yeah, I mean, not all of them, but if they had...
101 featurette.
Long movie.
You know, but if they had put, you know, there's seven dwarves, and, you know, we get pretty good on that. And so if they'd, you know, done, like, five dogs, and they, you know, they were kind of the ringleaders, then maybe I think the film would have really taken off.
So that's available right now in stores, right?
That is available.
Sleuth on the 11th, Dan in Real Life on the 4th. This one's available now. Buy it for your kids or you'll be in the doghouse. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. And I'm glad it's very popular. Obviously, parents are buying it because it's Disney. But I think it's an antidote to a lot of kind of the craziness in animation that kids watch nowadays.
Yeah, I got you. We just have a couple minutes left, and this is the creme de la creme title everyone's waiting to hear about.
Yeah, man.
Okay, this was surreal in that I literally got this on – the Oscars were Sunday, and I got this, like, that following Friday. So literally 5 days later, I get No Country for Old Men in the mail. And I don't know about you, but that's kind of surreal that you can get your Best Picture winner literally 5 days later in the mail.
Yeah.
So No Country for Old Men is out on DVD. Will be out on DVD on Tuesday. Coen Brothers had won four Oscars? You know, Best Picture, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Supporting Actor, Cinematography? No.
It won a shit ton.
It won four, Best Director, Best Picture, Best Adapted Screenplay, or?
Oh yeah, and Best Supporting Actor.
Yeah,
there you go. So there you go. And so, you know, now it's out. I think we've talked about. I think everyone in every critic.
Yeah, we know the quality.
We know the drill.
We know the quality.
Should they buy the DVD? That's the main question.
I think that's kind of a moot question right now. Obviously, people will buy the DVD, and the Coen brothers are a little cagey in that. Are they going to come back and do something special? My instinct tells me we might get something later down the line, just by the fact that this is the Best Picture winner, that I think almost by default that kind of demands a truly deluxe edition at some point.
Mm-hmm.
As it is now, you have three little featurettes that are perfectly fine, but they're not real. They don't really shed much light beyond, you know, promos. They're the infomercials produced by the studio at the outset. You know, not specifically for this DVD.
And this is why, and I'll keep this real short, but this is why I think sooner or later there's going to be some kind of at least attempt on behalf of DVD reviewers and critics and even some movie buffs that I do think the shortening of the window needs to stop and there needs to be a little more breathing room for when a film comes out theatrically and comes out on DVD.
That may or may not happen.
I just think that sooner or later, I do think we're in a transition right now. Whether it's for the good or bad, we obviously don't know yet. But I do think studios really ought to consider on that shortening window.
You're looking at a time when dollar theaters are playing the movies that are already out on video now, too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that
quick. We also have a recession that's
But the main thing is, if you obviously a great movie, if you have an itch to watch it again, and you just can't get by without watching it again, and you can suffice with once watching it again once, rent it, because I have a feeling that come November, come holiday time, you're going to see this again. That's my gut feeling.
Maybe with Burn After Reading comes out, you think, or.
Possibly, yeah. That has a release date now, so I wouldn't put it past him. I think that the disc is fine. It's serviceable. It gets it out there, but it's nothing for the movie geek to really feast on. But if you got to watch it, I would say rent it. If you're going to watch it over and over again, obviously buy it.
You obviously have to watch it, because people are still trying to figure out the last 20 minutes of the film.
Which I don't get.
Get that either.
But it is. It's unquestionable. It's a recommendation.
Oh yeah.
So No Country for Old Men, it will be coming out Tuesday. Coen Brothers, we all know the quality of it. We all know the story.
Right.
Even if you can't explain the story.
Okay, we're out of time, guys. Right. We'll be back Wednesday night with the director of Chapter 27, the new film starring Jared Leto and Lindsay Lohan. About the assassination of John Lennon. And Denise Mann, the author of Hollywood Independence. And I'll talk to you guys later. We're all out of time.
All right, thanks. Everyone have a good night. Thanks for listening.
Bye, guys.
Bye.